seen the sky so blue. The birds are singing, I got nothing to do. Hey, hey,
hey, hey.
It's a sunny day.
Sunny day now.
My pocket's empty, my cupboard's bare. But call me illogical, I just don't care. Hey, hey,
hey, hey, hey.
It's just a sunny day.
Hey, 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 it's a sunny day.
It's just a sunny day.
It's the KSL Greenhouse. Expert tips for flowers, trees, gardens, and soil. Our hosts are Maria Chaleos and Ton Bettis on KSL News Radio.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. Maria and Ton with you. We do have a special guest this morning as well, but I want you to know, Ton, our texters have let me know very clearly that they like your crazy comments and for me not to try to stop you.
Well, I do
so
need
I'm
to be...
So I'm just going to give you free reign, and then if you are being bad, it's not up to me.
You keep me from getting in trouble, so...
That's what I thought I
all
was
good.
Doing, but
so
they,
please
they
keep
like
it.
It
up.
They like it.
Please
so
keep it up.
This morning, our top of the hour feature is maple syrup production. So tell our listeners why you want to talk about
this.
Well,
I was wandering around at Extension Annual Conference a week or two ago in a kind of a get-to-know-the-specialists and projects... what's going on at USU Extension. And I went past a booth where there were a set of grad students actually making maple syrup from local Big Tooth maple. Now, I know this isn't unheard of, but they've taken it to the point that you can actually buy local maple syrup from a few families down in southern Utah County in the Elk Ridge area. And there's potentially even a festival they do. And I was just so fascinated that someone was researching making this commercial that I thought it'd be a good topic. But then they're also turning box elder trees, which are a species of maple, and Norway maple, and tapping them for syrup too. It's like, we've got to have them on. The nerd in me, the plant nerd, got the best of me.
Okay, so we are bringing on right now Jesse Matthews. He's a graduate researcher with Utah State University. Good morning, Jesse. Thanks for being with me.
Awesome. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So how long have you been tapping maple trees?
So this is my third year of tapping maple trees here in Utah.
And what was this, just something the major professor says, I've got this project, or were you already interested in it?
Yeah, so I actually was just kind of at the right place at the right time. I worked as an undergrad research assistant, and this project kind of started as I was an undergrad assistant, and then I graduated and became a graduate research assistant. And he got a grant to study this here in Utah, and so I was just kind of in the right lab and got involved in it that way.
No, that's excellent. So as you are researching these maples, can you briefly walk us through the process of actually tapping a native Big Tooth maple?
Yeah, it's pretty easy. You just got to have a spile, which is your little part that you put into the tree, and a bucket, and a lid, preferably something to cover it so nothing falls into it. And really, once you have that, you just get a drill bit, anything from Home Depot works, and you drill a hole about 1.5 inches deep. Then you use a hammer to pound your spile in, and then hang your bucket, and you're off to the races. It's pretty simple.
So how much syrup do you get out of the tree, and then can you just eat it like that, or what do you have to do to it?
Yeah, so the sap, when it comes out of the tree, is about 2% sugar, and it's got lots of nutrients and minerals in it. So a lot of people will just drink the sap as you get it straight out of the tree. And you get about, from box elder, on average, you get about 7 gallons of sap from a tree, and that can vary a lot. You can get a lot more or a lot less depending on your tree. For Big Tooth maple, it's a little less. It's closer to like 5 gallons of sap. But then if you want to make maple syrup, you need to boil that down. And so it goes from 2% sugar in the sap, and maple syrup is 67% sugar. And so the general quoted ratio is about 40 gallons of sap make a gallon of syrup.
So that's a lot of boiling to get it concentrated.
Yeah. So it's really easy to do it. You just keep it on the stove for a long time.
Doesn't this hurt the poor tree? Like, that's a lot of sap to come out of a tree, isn't it?
Not really. We're taking such a small portion that they don't even really notice it. And the hole that you drill is so small, it's a lot less damage than you see with other wounding scars that happen naturally in nature. So it really, the tree hardly even notices this tiny little hole that you put into it or what you take out of it. We're accessing such a small part of what's going on in the tree that the tree doesn't even really notice.
So have you, I noticed that you had the finished retail bottles at the conference. So how has the public received the local maple syrup as far as taste and what kind of comments are you getting?
Yeah, everyone absolutely loves it. If you're familiar with maple syrup from back east, we get that, those come from sugar maples, red maples, silver maples. It's often has kind of a strong flavor that a lot of people don't like if you're not used to it. But this maple syrup that we've produced here has a lot lighter flavor. People have said it has caramel notes to it or buttery notes to it. Everyone kind of has their own take on it, but everyone absolutely loves it. It's a little bit easier of a flavor. It's not as strong.
So I guess you'd have to become a maple syrup sommelier to really start figuring a lot of this stuff out. And so on the box elder syrup and the Norway maple syrup, what have the comments been on them?
So box elder and Norway maple haven't been produced and sold to anyone. So
okay.
I only have my personal notes on that because I've made them individually. Just me. And they both have their own little different flavors. It all tastes like maple syrup. It's all really sweet. Box elder syrup definitely has a unique flavor just because it kind of, they're just a unique tree in general in the maple species world. And Norway maple is actually really sweet as well. But you get a lot less Norway maple syrup or sap from the tree, so it's a lot harder to produce.
So I had heard that of all the maple species, that Norway was the hardest to tap because of that. And so it's just interesting to me. Where do people find out more information about local maple syrup?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we've got lots of resources. We hold workshops starting in probably about October, November, and going through February. We have workshops that are held all over the place. I've also produced and written fact sheets to help guide people through the whole process, everything from identifying which trees I can tap all the way through creating your own maple syrup. And so those fact sheets are available on the Utah State University website. And I think the one that you want to start with is titled Producing Maple Syrup from Box Elder and Norway Maple Trees.
Okay, Jesse, before we let you go, I have to ask, though, this isn't something somebody can go out, do today, buy a tree, and then start. How mature does the tree have to be before you can tap it?
Yes, that's a great question. Very important. The general rule of thumb is you want to tap at about 10 inches in diameter. So you can tap smaller, but 10 inches is the safe tapping size, and anything bigger, you can definitely tap.
So if you're tapping wild trees, those trees could easily be 50 to 100 years old before they are suitable for tapping.
Yeah, in general, they're going to be, well, depending on the species, box elder trees, probably within 20 years.
So I'm referring to the big tooth.
Probably takes a lot longer.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're more of a scrubby multi-trunk, and so it's hard to find large big tooth maples. So for my research, we've been tapping clear down to 7 inches for big tooth maple just because it's so hard to find those bigger ones.
All right, Jesse, thank you so much for sharing your information with us today.
Yeah, I'm happy to. I love this.
Before you go, quick question. Are there any local retailers of especially the big tooth maple syrup?
There's only one, and it's in Woodland Hills, Utah. And we're getting to the end of the season. They've got tons of bottles this year. And it's right now, this is their second year. It's only sold at one place, and that is they hold a maple syrup festival. This year, it's on April 20th at 10 o'clock, starting at 10 o'clock in Woodland Hills in a park called Lauritsen Field. That's the only place where you can buy locally produced maple syrup in Utah.
Very good. So maybe we'll have you hold on the line off the air, and I'll have Michelle get that information from you and we might be able to put it on our social media, but we greatly appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, that sounds great. Thank you for having me.
All right, Jesse, thank you. That is Jesse Matthews. He's a graduate researcher with Utah State University talking about the Maple Syrup Project. Take a break. Coming back with your questions and your calls, you can call us now, 801-575-8255. Karen, you'll be up next. And you can text us at 57500. Good morning. Thank you for spending your Saturday morning with the KSL Greenhouse. Maria and Ton with you, taking your calls and questions. Ton, we needed to correct something that we talked about earlier. I asked you about ramps.
Yes.
And you had never heard of ramps.
No.
And then you got texts, and then you got email. Yeah.
Liz Binks, who is one of our USU Extension insect diagnosticians and overall good gardener and just a good person, texted me and saying that wasn't
autocorrect ramps or a thing. So what are they?
They are an onion species, an allium species that are native to Europe and Eastern North America, that you only have a window of about 2 weeks to harvest, and they're perennial, and you can get a patch started where it looks like they grow is kind of in woodsy, dappled shade areas, but they're very slow to establish.
Okay, and so can be grown here.
I suspect they can. Nobody I know of is growing them. Liz wasn't, but she was more up to speed on them than me. But I suspect they would grow here, because if they're growing in New Hampshire and Massachusetts, if you had an area here with organic matter and things, I think they would be fine.
All right, Liz, thanks for listening and clarifying for us. Karen is on the line in Riverton. Good morning, Karen. What was your question this morning?
Good morning. My question pertains to adding nitrogen to grow boxes. We've had grow boxes for about 15 years, and self-made soil with a compost, the peat, and the vermiculite, done wonderful. Finally had it tested. I was just curious. And my test from USU came back with very high phosphorus and potassium, and only recommended to add nitrogen. So my question is, when is the best time to put it in the soil? Do I put it now?
No, when you plant. Nitrogen is so mobile that I would download the fact sheets for whatever crops you're growing from USU's website, and it will give you instructions on when to apply nitrogen. It's just assumed that the soil is low in nitrogen because it just is so water soluble, it doesn't stay in the soil long. So on your raised beds, have you been adding compost back in every fall or periodically?
Yes, we do.
Okay, good.
We do add it.
Good. So yeah, just straight nitrogen fertilizer. And so when you read USU fact sheets, they may say 16, 16, 16 or 10, 10, 10 or 20, 0, 0. Just assume that you're using 20, 0, 0 or 21, 0, 0 and use that for your nitrogen source so you're not putting the other two nutrients in.
Okay. And as I look, there's the ammonium sulfate and there's also blood meal. Is there one that's better than the other?
No, not necessarily. Ammonium sulfate is the 20-0-0. That's just the analysis of it. And blood meal, I believe, is a 12%. And so you would need to do the math on the because the first number in the analysis is nitrogen. And if it's saying use 2 tablespoons of 20-0-0, which is the phosphate, then blood meal, you would double that to get the same amount of nitrogen.
Okay. Great.
All right,
thank you,
Karen.
So much. Thank you.
Thanks so much for your call this morning.
Mm-hmm.
Next listener wants to know, should they top dress their lawn? How would they decide if it was time to do a little bit of overseeding?
If they need to top dress the lawn because the grass is thin or they have a lot of weeds, they need to figure out why it's thin or why the weeds are there, because top dressing at best will be a temporary solution.
Can they do that now if they need to?
They can, yes.
Okay. This next listener says they had bazillions of grasshoppers the last couple of years. Is there something that they can do now to prepare in defense?
You know, USU has some really good grasshopper fact sheets out there. And to truly control them, it's a neighborhood-wide effort. Mm-hmm. And during COVID, one of our main defenses, which was called NoloBait, the company that manufactures it either went bankrupt or they've had failures. I don't know. But NoloBait has not been available. And that was a bait you would put out in the spring. As soon as you started seeing the little baby grasshoppers, they would eat it, and then they would either die or not feed anymore and die. But since that tool is gone, then that leaves us with other strategies. And in your yard, if it's just you, you can observe the plants they like the best and spray them with an insecticide and use those as a trap crop to keep them out of your other garden areas. And so if they're coming from a certain direction and you know that they like, say, marigolds, you might plant two or three rows of marigolds on the edge of the garden because they're going to prefer those, and you might be able to spray the marigolds and not have to spray in your garden.
Ah.
And so there's some things like that you can do, but download USU's fact sheets on grasshoppers. And if you have some neighbors that are cooperative, you might be able to work with them, because the more neighbors that participate, the better the control is going to be, because the grasshoppers are so mobile. Even if you eliminate them from your yard, it's just a few hours before they start hopping back in.
All right. Next listener wants to know, is it okay to use water from a rain barrel to water your vegetables? They're wondering if the chemicals from the shingles would harm the vegetables.
I think you're fine.
Okay.
That falls all over your lawn, and the lawn usually survives okay. And so it's just one of those things that the rainwater is in contact with those shingles for such a short period of time. And there's generally on those shingles, there might even be a light coating of lime or calcium carbonate just from rain and things. Mm-hmm. And so as far as watering your plants with it, you're perfectly fine.
Okay. And the next listener wants to know, what is the optimum exposure for a mock orange, and how much dead stock can they cut off from them without killing them?
If it's dead, just cut it out. You're not going to kill anything.
Yeah, cut the dead off. They may not know if it's living right now.
Yeah, and so mock orange, when you prune them after they're done blooming, and you go in and take 25 to 30% of the branches out toward the middle of the bush, starting with the oldest, longest branches, and then you can give it a light haircut, but you do it within just a few days after it's done blooming, because it's forming flower buds for the next year very soon. And so if you do that, the mock orange are beautiful, but they have a tendency to get leggy and just kind of not great looking if you don't prune them. But renewal pruning keeps their shape. They want at least 6 hours of sunlight a day. 8 is better.
So. All right. We need to take a break for the bottom of the hour news. When we come back, Reed, your call will be up next. Then Wendy. Number to call with your questions, 801-575-8255. You can text us, 57500.
The Greenhouse Show on KSL News Radio.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. Maria Chalais, Ton Bettis with you, taking your calls at 801-575-8255. You can also text us at 57500. Reed has been waiting very patiently in Orem. And good morning, Reed. What was your question this morning?
Hi, Maria and Tom. I appreciate you taking my call. We installed our sprinkler system about 20 years ago, and at that time decided to broadcast spray our shrubs, our bushes, and our trees. But I'd like to convert that to drip irrigation, and I have what I think is a good design. The trees we have now are a 3-inch caliper peach tree, 3-inch caliper swamp tree, and an older 3-inch crab apple. I'm just wondering at what rate I should be watering these and where to place the emitters, and any advice you have as I do this.
Well, the trees, once you install drip, it's not going to be a static system like a traditional sprinkling system would. As the tree canopies grow, every 3 or 4 years, you're going to have to put in another circle of drip around the trees. And so you keep that in mind and have the capacity to increase the number of either drip emitters or inline. And I would actually recommend inline the hose or the where you have evenly spaced emitters on the tubing instead of just the individual emitters, just so that you can cover better. And you'd put those every couple of feet circling almost like a bullseye target under the canopy of the tree. And so generally, and you need to know your soil type because it can be difficult to know how the spacing and how long to run, because in a sandy soil for those trees, you would probably want inline drip with emitters every foot, and you would space those every couple of feet because water just flows right through sand, but you wouldn't run it as long and you would run it more often because the sand dries out more quickly. If you have a loamy soil, which is great, then, you know, you might be able to space those a little bit farther apart, and 1 inch of water. So I don't know, do your emitters tell you gallons per hour or do they say inches per hour of water?
Gallons per hour.
So in gallons per hour. So if you had a square foot and you applied 1 inch of water to that square foot, what would happen is that in a loam soil that would penetrate 6 inches to a foot deep. In a sandy soil, it would go a foot to 2 feet, and in a clay, it would go 3 or 4 inches at the most and then go sideways. And as this water flows through the soil, in sand, it almost goes straight down. In the loam, it kind of forms a pyramid shape as it spreads out as it goes down, and then in clay, it almost goes sideways. And so you need to be aware of how water flows in your soil to know the spacing. And so what I'd recommend doing is having BYU or USU do a soil test to figure out if you've got loam, sand, or clay soil. And you can adjust your emitters according to how the water flows in the soil. But your goal is to drive water, if you have a loam or a sandy soil, especially 18 inches to 2 feet on your trees, to the, you know, toward the bottom of most of your feeder roots are going, and then you want those emitters spaced under the canopy.
And how long do you typically is this a deep watering once a week?
Hopefully, it is. If those trees are established once a week, maybe even every 10 days is great. But if they're brand new trees, then you may need to water a couple of times a week. And it's just really difficult for me to say, you know, run that irrigation for 45 minutes because all soils are different and the emitter spacing is different. And so what I would recommend doing is getting your soil type so that you can figure out if it's sand, silt, or clay, because that's going to have everything to do with your emitter spacing and your run time.
Okay. All right. I think that confirms some stuff that I've read online, and I'll get my soil tested.
Yeah, and if you're not in a super windy area and you haven't gone to this extent yet for your fruit trees and things, especially if they're not in your lawn, I might consider micro sprays that spray a foot or 18 inches off the ground, but go 5 or 6 feet wide, and using 2 or 3 of those per tree and letting them run for several hours so that you get a more even distribution of water under the canopy.
Okay, and if I have shrubs around those trees, it's just a matter of...
Then you have to use drip because the micro sprays will run into the shrubs and they won't water like they're supposed to.
Okay.
But there are some other options. I would hit a professional sprinkler store like Sprinkler Supply, The Sprinkler Store, Standard Plumbing. There's several of them out there. But I would talk to them on your situation, maybe bring in your plans, and they'll have somebody that can help you with spacing and pressure and things like that. But you do need to know your soil type.
Okay. Great. I appreciate your time and all the advice you continue to give to our community.
Thank you.
Thanks, Reed, for your call this morning. Next listener wanted to know, Ton, when and how to treat scale on a sycamore.
There's a few options. One of the easiest, but it might be a little more expensive, is to use something like Safari or Xylem and do a soil drench around the trunk of the tree this spring. and just let that absorb in. It can take a few months to get through the system, but either Safari or Xylem will knock those out. Otherwise, they can use dormant oils, but they need to be able to cover the canopy of the tree. If they can't, they're going to need to use a systemic.
All right, next person says they have a dwarf apple tree, but every year the apples are wormy. What can they do to fix the problem?
Look up USU's fact sheet on codling moth. They are going to be wormy because you need to spray multiple occasions through the season. And so USU's Pest Lab Updates, there's a fruit update that you can subscribe to for free. Google USU Pest Lab Updates. And what I would recommend doing is just subscribing, and they will tell you down to the day when you need to spray. They'll give you, when available, non-pesticide options, organic options, and standard options. So that's what I would do.
All right. Next listener is Wendy in Brigham City. Good morning, Wendy. What was your question this morning?
Morning. Thanks for taking my call. We have a dwarf pear tree. We've had probably 15 to 20 years, and the fruit has always been real good. And this past fall, when we got the fruit ready to can, I tasted it, and it tasted like turpentine. I sampled quite a few of the pears. They all tasted the same, so we had to throw away all the pears. We're wondering if we need to take the tree out. We kind of want to give it one more year to see if it'll rally and do better, but why
what
would it
do if
like
it was
that?
Your fault that the fruit was like that and not the trees?
What?
And not intentionally. And the tree didn't all of a sudden become demon possessed or anything. But a lot of times when the entire tree, all the pears taste like that, it's because of weather conditions or management practices. If it was a fruit here and there, you could blame it on a disease. But if it's the entire tree, something's gone wrong in the environment, usually to cause that to happen. And so how was the tree irrigated last year?
We have it in a corner of the yard that the sprinkler system hits. And then if it doesn't seem to be wet enough, I water it. I just drag the hose over and turn it on for a couple hours on real low water.
And how long are your sprinklers hitting it?
15 minutes tops.
15 minutes, so it may not be enough. What I would do is get a hose and sprinkler that will water under the canopy of the tree and run it every 2 to 3 weeks for an extra half hour to 45 minutes, besides what your lawn sprinklers are doing, to drive the water deeper. Last summer, we were so hot through July that where maybe if we stayed in the 90s, the water the tree was getting may have been sufficient. But I think that during a critical period of the season, the tree unintentionally didn't get enough water, and it caused the fruit to taste like that. And so the reason I suspect this is because commercial growers didn't have any problems with fruit as far as flavor and yields and things like that. And that usually, if homeowners are having problems, then it usually goes back to management practices. So I don't mean to accuse you of anything, and I didn't mean to, if it sounded like that, I apologize.
No,
but a lot of times, if the entire tree has fruit that doesn't taste good, then it's something that we didn't realize we needed to do that maybe caused that fruit to taste like that. So I would at least give it another year to see, with just increasing irrigation slightly to where you drive water down, you know, a good. So when you're going to water this is when your sprinklers run the next morning, I would go out there and just run a hose and sprinkler for an extra half hour to 45 minutes to get the water deeper, and do that twice a month and see if that helps.
Okay, great. Thank you.
If it doesn't and the pears taste bad again, there could be a disease in there, and then you could cut it down. But I would definitely give it another year.
That's kind of what we thought too.
All right, Wendy, thank you so much for your call this morning.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Our next listener, Ton, wants to know, they've had some tulips in a bag. They want to know what happens if they plant them now. They probably won't come up this year, but will they come up next year?
Probably not. They may leaf out, but not form flowers. I would definitely plant them, but so they don't get their hopes up, I might just dig an area or designate an area of my yard and see if they leaf out and let them do their thing. And then the next fall, they could move them where they want them if they do.
All right. We're going to take a break. Come back with your calls and questions. Number to call 801-575-8255. Text us 57500. Thank you for spending your Saturday morning with KSL Greenhouse. Maria Anton with you, taking your calls and questions. We only have a few minutes left in the program. And Tom, the next listener wants to know, they need to move a wisteria that's been growing in a pot. It's been in there about for 4 years now. They started it from seeds, but they're wondering if it's going to be tolerant to moving it at this point.
Yeah, it'd be a great time to move it before it breaks dormancy. If they can't pull it out of the pot, if it's a cement pot or a clay pot, they may need to shatter the pot carefully to get it out.
Mm-hmm.
If it's plastic, cut it. And if I wouldn't recommend using a Sawzall, but, you know, a strong blade, something or another to cut it. If it is a resin pot, then they may need to cut that also. If it is a brittle or harder pot, they might be able to shatter it, but it will need to come out. If it's too big, they may need to break the pot off, but it's a great time to transplant it.
Our next listener has 12 apple trees in their backyard. They want to plant a hedge of elderberries, but they're wondering if the elderberries will bring in birds and that might potentially harm their apple trees.
Not necessarily. Those elderberries ripen through late September into October. And the only danger would be if they have apples like Golden Delicious or a Fuji, that Granny Smith is another one that would ripen later in the season. When the elderberries are, it could bring birds in, but I think the birds, I can't be sure, but I think they'd preferentially take the elderberries over the apples.
All right. Blake is on the line in Pleasant View. Good morning, Blake. What was your question this morning?
Hey, big old question. I've got a tree, 8 years old, maple tree, Pleasant View. It needs iron. I had a guy put in some iron, but he's not around. What's the best way to put in iron? Because it's just not doing very well.
How big is the tree?
It's about 25 feet tall now.
Okay, so I would hit IFA, Cal Ranch, Steve Regan, a local garden center. I think you've got Jerry's up your way, J&J,
yeah,
Valley Nursery.
Yeah.
So I'd hit one of them and buy some, to tell them you need EDDHA iron. It's Miller Ferroplus. Yeah, EDDHA. So it's Miller Ferroplus or Grow More Chelated Iron.
Okay.
And read
all
the
right
instructions, because you may need more than one container. I don't think so, but what you're going to do is look at the instructions, and it'll tell you how much to apply per inch of trunk width. And you'll mix that up in 5 gallon buckets and just drench it under the canopy of the tree, not just by the trunk, but you're going back and forth to the edge of the tree, and then get your hose out and water that in for 15 or 20 minutes to drive the iron down into the soil.
Okay. Hey, some guy said I should drill in the trunk.
No,
like 12
that's
holes
last ditch. The tree's going to die before you do that, because every hole you drill and inject iron into, you get a 2-inch ring that rots. And so
and
so if you do that too often, you can actually girdle the tree, and it is not good for it. That's only if the tree is going to die. And so you want to do this chelated iron treatment. But what I would do in addition to that is maybe get some liquid micronutrients and mix in with it. And also, and you're going to kind of make a witch's brew, I would get some liquid chelate, liquid humates or some granular humates, and put those down at the same time. And I would also get some liquid nitrogen and put it down all at once. And you might need to apply separately, but, you know, within the same hour, because what you're trying to do is maximize uptake of the micronutrients and the iron. And the nitrogen may help a little bit. The chelate or the humates may help a little bit. And just you're doing everything you can do to pull this tree out of being unhealthy.
All right, Blake. Thank you so much for your call this morning.
Yeah.
That's it for the KSL Greenhouse. Show goes by just so quickly. We appreciate you joining us this morning. If you've missed a portion of the show, you can find it in podcast form at kslpodcast.com. 8 o'clock hour, we talked about summer bulbs. You can find out more information about the summer blooming bulbs on the KSL Greenhouse Facebook page. Then we talked to the Utah Rose Society at 9 and then learned about maple syrup production in the state at 10. So, Ton, have a great weekend.
You have a great weekend also.
All right. And thank you again for listening to the KSL Greenhouse. We appreciate your calls and texts.